Okay, today is March 13, 2017, Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on General Government. Today we'll be holding a public hearing on SB 5535, Department of Revenue, Income Tax Programs, Personal Tax and Compliance Division, Joanne Martin, Administrator, and Business Director Eric Smith, Administrator. So, the floor is yours.
Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you, and Co-Chair Manning and members of the committee. As noted, I'm Joanne Martin. I am the Administrator for the Personal Income Tax Division.
And my name is Eric Smith. I'm the Administrator of the Business Division. A couple of you may remember me as being here as the Program Management Office Administrator in the past. A year ago, I took on the Business Division Administrator job, and that's my new role with the department. Today, we're going to be covering our income tax programs, which primarily will focus on the personal income tax, the withholding tax portion of the personal income tax program, and corporate tax programs. We're going to give you an overview of our programs, some background of our program areas, and in a few weeks, we're going to be back here on April 10th, and we're going to go into more depth on some topics that we'll touch on today that have to do with collections and accounts receivable, as well as the tax gap and as well as tax fraud. So though today we're going to give you an overview on some of those categories, in a couple weeks, I think the week of April 10th is when we're tentatively scheduled, we'll come back and have more in-depth conversation about that.
Okay, so before we get started, let me ask staff here, John, we got a background on this.
I'm sorry, Senator, I was just going to say the schedule for phase two is still very tentative, so
okay.
All the dates are kind of up in the air, so we'll get them settled here in the next few weeks.
Okay.
So thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Thank you, Co-Chair.
Okay, great. Thank you. I hope we just get us started by reviewing one of the slides that Director Ray showed you when she met with you the last time she was here. And just quickly to recap, to give again a bit of an idea about why we're here today is to talk about the personal income tax program, the corporate cigarette tax, estate and tobacco taxes, and just giving you again that feel for how much of those programs contribute to the general fund. And what this slide is showing you is that there is, you know, obviously a very large contribution by the personal income tax program of about $15.68 billion per biennium as shared by the Office of Economic Analysis through the December 2016 forecast. And again, showing that the corporate program generates about $1.1 billion. And then again, other sources are made up from lottery and then our cigarette and tobacco programs. So today we'll be focusing more on the personal income tax program, the withholding, and the corporate taxes.
On this slide, I'm going to give an overview just of the income tax program functions that we'll be talking about today. Outreach and assistance is a big part of our role. We do a lot of processing, verification, and validation of information that we receive from taxpayers. We have a significant enforcement function that includes audit and collections, and of course, the reporting and accounting functions that go along with our business. But today, we're going to break our conversation into our five outcome areas. We have five outcome areas that drive us in our business initiatives, and they are voluntary compliance, enforcement, employee engagement, customer experience, and equity and uniformity. And so Joanne and I are going to begin our work with the voluntary compliance.
Okay, and just again to give you a little bit of magnitude and a little bit of information about the personal income tax program, each year we receive about 2.1 million returns filed from taxpayers. Additionally, the personal income tax program is also responsible for partnerships, and so we gain about 63,000 returns each year on that. And again, as I just noted, that equates to about $15.6 billion in personal income tax revenues for the 15-17 biennium. For the division itself, my biennial budget is $71.4 million, and that equates to about 422.81 staff that help us carry out our activities throughout the biennium. Go ahead and switch to the next one. Okay, the current slide that I'm showing you just gives you, again, a depiction of how important voluntary compliance is for our personal income tax program, and actually, well, any of the programs that we have at Revenue. And what we're focusing on with this slide is, again, just the impact that voluntary compliance has on how revenue comes in. And what this chart is showing you is that most of the income does come in through voluntary payments, and that would be things like withholding payments, quarterly estimated tax payments someone might make, or, again, payments that are made with return. When returns are filed. That's about 97% of the dollars that come in from the program come in through voluntary sources. And then the little brown or tan wedge that we're showing you is the income that comes in through our actual enforcement activity, and that would be things like auditing, return adjustments, things like that, as people file returns and we take a look at those. One of the items that I also wanted to share is that there's a number of things that we do that helps to support voluntary compliance. We do try to provide online services for taxpayers so they can self-serve and take care of their filing needs. So a couple of things I wanted to just highlight again for you today is how we support that. Through our new GenTax system, we do have increased online services, so we're able to provide ways for people to make payments or payment plans. They can file an appeal online. They can submit documents to us. In addition, one of the enhancements that we've also been able to give is that practitioners who can associate with their clients, they can also look at the information that their clients have on file with us as well, which just helps everybody to be a little bit better informed. We also provide person-to-person services through our taxpayer call center, and each year that area processes about 140,000 phone calls each year. We also have an interactive voice response system that processes a lot of services for taxpayers as well and helps them to get information. In my personal income tax program in our collection area, they answer about 16,000 calls a month, or around 160,000 calls per year that they field through those services. Additionally, we have 5 field offices that are in the outlying areas from Salem, and that includes Bend, Medford, Eugene, Gresham, and Portland. And we do have a field presence also within our Salem headquarters. Our field offices are primarily out there for collecting and auditing functions, but they also provide customer service for walk-ins and people who call. They provide about 42,000 services to about 42,000 people across those field offices that come into the office, and around 10,000 calls are fielded. Additionally, not only do we provide in-person service, but we also try to meet with other people that have interest in working with the department. So on a quarterly basis, we work with the Oregon State Bar and the Certified Public Accountants on a quarterly meeting just to, again, understand issues and concerns that may come up. One of the things that we have also done just recently is that we had heard that there was concern about practitioners being able to get enough information and service from us in a timely manner. We did restart our practitioner message line that we've had for a number of years and ended up halting it for a while, and we resurrected that in December and have a 24-hour turnaround for people who want to call in and get information and assistance from us. So as you can see, for us, voluntary compliance is a really big factor in how we do get dollars in and support the general fund.
Representative Gomber.
Thank you. I just wanted to back up for a second. And you showed that very small slice of the pie for
yes.
audits and collections.
Right.
And I'm going to infer from that audits is when you review my tax return and decide that I made some mistakes.
Right.
Collections is when I send you a tax return, but I don't send you a check. Could you give us a sense of how that small slice of the pie might be divided between those two functions?
I'm not sure if I can give you an exact dollar figure that I have in front of me today. I can tell you that our collections brings in probably around $180 million per year. And then the audit, the part that's hard to equate the audit is we do our billings, but we don't necessarily know that all the dollars will be collected. So we tend to count that through the collection resources. I can see if I can get you that information, though, Representative Gomberg, just to make sure I've got that clear. But I would say it's probably most of it is on the collection side, and then the audits are there to keep. And we'll talk about that when we get to the enforcement piece.
Right.
Maybe I'll lay a clearer picture out. But most of our enforcement work is there to help keep the voluntary system healthy and people filing when we do returns. Excuse me.
Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, perhaps the agency can clarify that the graph is general fund only, because. Is that accurate?
That is accurate. Thank you, John, for that.
Thank you. So, in other words, it does not include the other agency accounts, which will be discussed later. Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Kutcher.
Okay. And as I was saying, one of the biggest pieces that we have as far as voluntary compliance goes is making sure that we have a good process for getting returns in, processing them, and also verifying returns as they come in. We are fortunate that about 87% of our population does file their return electronically, or e-filing as we refer to that. And about 13% is filed through paper return. That can also include 2D barcode. And it's about 60% are 2D barcode and about 40% are paper. And for those of you who might not know what 2D barcode is, when a person prints out the return, there's a little box. Or if you think about it, if you're at the store and you go over the scanners with your grocery products, there's a code that's read. Well, the return has that, and we can scan that with a wand that captures the information, and somebody doesn't have to manually key it. We're in a paper return. We have to manually key. So there's a big benefit for us to continue to increase our e-filing as much as we can, or at least the 2D as well. Just again, to give a recap about the PIT program, we moved into our new Gentex system in December of 2015. So last year was the first year that we processed and used the system once we migrated over to it. I will admit that last year was a challenging year for us. We had a lot to learn. We did process things slower. And our staff had a lot of learning on the fly as we went into the filing season to learn how to use the system. The good thing is that we have a lot of business rules that we can use and adjust, and we did that as we worked through this through last year, but we did have a little bit slower processing season than what we would have liked. We also had some other activities going on last year as well that added to some of our return processing that slowed down things a bit. We had a kicker year, and a lot of times taxpayers don't completely understand how to treat that on the tax return, so that there was a lot of different mistakes made, or we may have to verify information as a result, again, of how folks file their return. Again, effectively processing our returns is core to our system and to our process, and we constantly strive in order to do a better job on that. One of the other things that happens when we are verifying returns is we are looking for just basic errors, but we're also looking for fraud. Last year, one of the things that we gained was a fraud tool that helped us to identify potential returns. As we were learning how to use the system, we, in essence, cast a wide net that brought in a lot of returns that we had to look at. And some of those returns we might not needed to have stopped, but as we were learning how to use our tool, we brought in a lot of returns. One of the things that we've done this year is adjusted our rules, and we're not capturing as many returns, and we are definitely processing faster than we did in the previous year.
This next graph is just a visual of the outreach efforts Joanne's mentioned briefly already. This information is for this particular biennium up through January, and the map is based on population density, and the circles enumerate where we've held our outreach activities across the state through January. We participate in events that reach employers and tax practitioners, such as attorneys, CPAs, licensed tax consultants. And our goal is to help them to understand Oregon's filing requirements, to the tax laws, worker classification responsibilities. Our withholding program, which I'll be giving an overview on in a moment, held 147 events this biennium so far, and we've reached over 5,000 attendees through those events. And Joanne's division has held 24 new law schools in 14 different cities across the state, of which over 1,600 practitioners have attended. As she mentioned, also our field offices were a source of outreach, and the quarterly meetings she discussed. And so we do spend a fair amount of effort trying to get the information in people's hands so that they can accurately file. Switching over to the business division program, so the personal income tax program administers the personal income tax and partnerships, and the business division, we administer the withholding tax program, as well as the corporate tax, and I'll talk a little bit about estate tax as well. And so the employers are responsible for remitting the employees' wages to the or tax from the employees' wages to the department. And for fiscal year 16, we received over $6 billion, $6.5 billion of employer withholding payments. And we received those from a little over 130,000 filers. But we also collect for two transit districts, for the TriMet Transit District in the Portland metro area, as well as the Lane Transit District in the Eugene area. And we collected over $300 million for those districts and distributed them to, as well. One of the things that we've tried to do here in Oregon is to try and streamline filing requirements as much as we can for businesses. And so one of the things we do is offer a combined return where we have a partnership with the Oregon Employment Division, the Department of Consumer and Business Services, as well as the transit districts that I just mentioned. And an employer, if they happen to be doing business in all those areas, can file one return, and then they can cover their responsibilities or liabilities for all those programs on one return. The Oregon Department Employment Department processes the return, and when they process the return, they send the information out to the various agencies or entities. The Department of Revenue processes the payments, and based on how the taxpayer has directed us to distribute those payments, we send those payments out to the other agencies. One other thing I draw to your attention is another effort to try and streamline for businesses is the Oregon Business Registry. That's something that the Secretary of State hosts and sponsors, and we, along with several other agencies, participated in that as well. So a new business can register with that registry, and then we get the information we need for our program as other agencies also receive it for theirs. In the corporate tax program, and this information on this slide comes from good work that's done from our research department. We have a really good team of economists that do a lot of work, work that's available to you if you aren't familiar with it. It's on our website. If you go to our revenue website, on the front page on the upper right corner, there's a section called Government and Researchers, and they publish reports, some of them annually, and this is from our annual corporate report. They have one for personal income tax as well as property tax and other sources of information. But for fiscal year 15-16, our corporate tax program generated a little over $600 million in revenue, and that came from a little over 90,000 returns that were filed. About two-thirds of those were S-corporation returns, and one-third of those were C-corporations. And something that's kind of interesting about the corporate tax program in Oregon is that the top 3% of filers actually pay over 80% of the tax for C-corporations. We also have a minimum tax in Oregon, as you're probably aware, and here on this slide I show how the minimum tax is charged. And just quickly, as we wrap up our section on voluntary compliance, in the business division we also administer the estate transfer tax. It's for estates that have a value of over $1 million. We usually have around 1,000 to 1,500 returns a year for that. And the OAA forecast for next biennium is for around $260 million for that tax. Our LAB for the current biennium was $38.2 million, and we have 211.74 FTE in our division. That also helps fund other programs, which I'll be back here tomorrow to talk about, such as marijuana, other agency accounts, and our special programs. And that concludes our section on voluntary compliance and the things that we do to help with that.
All right. Now we're going to move into the area of enforcement. And as the question was asked earlier, enforcement activities include auditing, which is inspecting both the personal income tax returns if you're in my area. That would be also if somebody files, like a business owner has a Schedule C or a farm, maybe a Schedule F. We also look at pass-through entities such as partnerships, and we kind of cross over with Eric's area where we do some S-corporation and domestic C work as well. Our new system provides us with many benefits that helps us to enhance our leads, being able to find productive leads that are worth, you know, while for us to look at, but also help educate taxpayers is something that we have always somewhat struggled to get to. Our new system provides us a tool that allows us to pull in information and different data sources, so we can take a look at the returns and identify and match that with federal information. And that is what we call our discovery tool. But one of the biggest things we find in our auditing and enforcement is that when the public knows and is aware that we do look at returns, that does promote more voluntary compliance. People do not want to be audited or have somewhat of a fear, not that we're out trying to scare them, but just the fact that, you know, that their return could be looked at, we believe has a presence in helping keep people within the system. Our discovery module is also used to help us find taxpayers who don't file and need to file. Again, as I stated, we're able to match information with federal information and other data sources, so we can create a listing of who needs to file. One of the enhancements that we receive from our new system is that we can match that information up front. We can create notices and send those out, and we don't have to have staff do that manual work. we've been able to utilize that staff in other areas, such as looking at fraud returns that are suspected for fraud, or again, just processing returns during our busy processing season. To give you an example of how we've benefited from our new system, over the past 10 months, we were able to create 57,000 failure to file notices. To give a comparison, in the previous biennium, we issued about 71,000 for the entire two-year period. So we are certainly able to produce a lot more. However, that does come with some impact, and one of the things that you'll see as we talk a little bit later, as there is an impact to the accounts receivable balance when we do a large amount of filing enforcement cases. A lot of times those are definitely based on estimated information. We're working off the best information we know about a taxpayer and their situations, and a lot of times those returns also do have penalties and interest along with them. So just the billing in general is a lot larger than if I'm just doing a straight audit because you filed a return and I'm determining that you owe something different. And again, as I said, I just wanted to emphasize that that does have a big impact on the accounts receivable.
Yes. Representative Gomberg.
Thank you. I need to just go back one slide.
Sure.
Because you just said to us that in the last few months you sent out 57,000 demands, but the slide says it's for tax year 2013.
Yeah, let me clarify what that meant, Chair Manning and Representative Gomberg. This last 10 months we were able to send out leads for tax year 2013, so we're working backwards or a couple years behind. So that was the number of leads that we had identified that needed to be sent out to folks for tax year 2013. I just lost my place on your question.
You asked about the year.
Right. So that's for tax year 2013, even though we are in filing 2016 right now. So those leads are identified from a previous filing year when people should have filed and didn't. Does that make sense? I hope.
If we follow up, Mr. Chairman, if I'm understanding you correctly, that you are working your bit way back through and you have these demand letters out covering a 4 to 5 year period then?
Right. We on filing enforcement, we're able to actually go back until a person hasn't filed, so we could go back countless years if we want. One of the policy decisions we have made at the department is we realize people can get really dug into a deep hole if we go back 20 years, even if they should have filed for 20 years. So one of the things that we do is we try to go back somewhere in the 3 to 6 year range, looking at who needs to file and send notices to let folks know that we're aware that they have wages that they should be filing and get them into the system so we can get them, again, hopefully voluntarily moving forward into the system and paying in as they should. And again, one thing that I do also want to mention about filing enforcement that's a little bit tricky is it could be once a person files, they may not actually end up owing. They may actually end up with a refund situation, and we just don't know at the time when we've discovered that they have a filing need. I hope that makes
That does. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a real quick follow-up. So you send me a letter saying you didn't file in 2014 and I ignore you.
Right.
What happens then? Maybe that's in a future slide, but what happens if I just ignore you?
Right. Chair Manning and Representative Gomberg, if you ignore us, we first of all, we start sending, you know, in a sense, nice letters saying we think you need to file, please do so. And you don't, so then we'll send you another letter saying we're pretty sure you need to file, please do so. And then if you don't, we send what we call a demand to file notice. And that is, in a sense, an assessment that we give you saying, we now think that you had this much income. We don't know if you're still married, if maybe you were at one point. We don't know if you have children, but we pretty much put you in as a single filer, and this is what your taxes that you owe. Then we would add any penalty and interest that would be applicable. From that period forward, if you didn't file for 2015, we would be notifying you most likely at the same time, as well as, well, for 2016, we won't start working on that until after the filing extension this October. But we're able to get more current with our new system and the tools that we have today with our leads and getting in touch with folks. So I hope that has answered your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
That raised a very interesting question. Since we're going back to 2013, some years ago and stuff, estimate how much money has been uncollected to date?
All right, let me see if I can find my notes on that.
$629,451,807, Mr. Chairman.
Well, and you could probably say about 50% of that, not quite exactly, is roughly filing enforcement. I do have a slide in a little bit that'll show that for you, but roughly about half of our accounts receivable for the personal income tax program as a result of filing enforcement. Thank you. Okay. And what I'm just going to quickly show you with this slide is just to give you, again, an idea. I've been telling you we have this new tool that gives us a few more sources, helps us to choose audit cases a little bit better. And the dark blue bars that you're seeing is just, again, an easy visual of where we've been able to find returns where we're getting a greater adjustment per return than some of our previous tools and tactics that we were able to use. And that's one of the things that I just wanted to demonstrate with this slide is that we are gaining in the sense of finding returns that are well worth our time to spend staff time on. But I also want to share, too, that not everything is about the system. We are always looking for different ways to be effective and efficient. And one of the things that our auditors now deploy is when they do audit a tax return, we can look at what we call three open years. And if I adjust a return in, let's say, tax year 2015, and you made the same mistake in 14 and 13, what we do is we ask the taxpayer to please amend those other returns. So then we can not only get the tax dollars in that we need to get in, but we can then move on and look at other tax returns and not spend all of our time with just one or two people, but we're able to spread our resources to a broader spectrum of people in our auditing.
Just another, because that's a lot of money out there. who or what population or what group is more prone to not paying than everyone else?
I think it's a kind of across the board in my experience. I started the department as an auditor years ago, and I see anything from wage earners to people who are in business. We have people that are in even possibly corporations or partnerships that don't file. It just kind of crosses a broad spectrum. I would say a lot of the people that we can identify easily tend to be wage earners because there's some information out there like a W-2 or something like that. Or if someone is a contract worker and there's perhaps a 1099 issued, we can find that information that helps us to locate who the people are. But I would say that it's just a good broad spectrum of filers that don't participate at times. I may be able to get a little bit of breakdown on that. I just don't have that breakdown with me today.
Okay. Thank you.
Ready to go on? All right, and the slide that I have up for you today, and one thing I want to be careful about is I'm not the fraud expert. I have someone that's going to come in a couple weeks when we come in phase two and give you a little bit more in-depth information about all the different things we do around fraud. But what I wanted to touch today was just to let you know that, again, one, to thank the committee. We've had support from you, not only in getting our new a processing system and our Gentech system at the agency, but also last biennium we were given a POP in order to acquire a fraud module. And what that has been enables us to do is to be able to have just a better tool to identify what we believe are fraudulent filed returns. We also were able to get some information added to through the employment department, so we have just more data sources to check against, is this a real return or not, or is this a real person, that kind of thing. So that has just been a tremendous help to us. And again, what I'm showing you with this slide is that while, again, it looks like we've got this great big green bar under 2016, so last year we were able to stop about 8,000 returns, and that equated to about $5.2 million that we stopped from going out the door. But it also is showing you by the tan bar that doesn't show very much because it's pretty minuscule, is that we're also sending out less refunds than we should. But I do have to put a cautionary statement out there, and again, I'm sure you'll hear this more when you hear about fraud in our deeper report, is that we do only know what we can detect, and we certainly are always doing our best to detect, but fraudulent activity and people that are fraudsters are always kind of, trying to be one step ahead of us, so it's always a vigilant task that we have to stay on top of our the fraud that could be potentially happening at the agency. One other last thing I'll say about fraud is last year we did see a little bit of a downward trend, which was a little bit of a surprise to us. And as we checked in a little bit on the national level and then with some of our other state partners, we did find that everyone was seeing a little bit of a downward trend. But unfortunately, there's still a lot of fraud activity that happens. Okay, I'm going to kind of move us onward to another part of the enforcement work that we do, and that is around the accounts receivable and collection. And again, what this slide is just summarizing for you is just to give you an idea, again, of what causes increases to the accounts receivable. As I mentioned, we have people who file returns. We call those self-assessed, and that they may either partially pay or not pay at all when they submit the return. So any remaining balance owing obviously increases the AR. We also, when we do our audit work, we do assessments as well, and that adds to the AR. And then the estimated debt is what I was just talking about, which is filing enforcement. And that plus penalties and interest obviously increase the accounts receivable. Activities that we do that help to decrease it are, and sometimes people self-cure. They actually will send payments in and pay, or they'll call in or get online and make their own payment arrangements. But sometimes they call us and we help them with making payment arrangements as well. Those activities help us to decrease. But if need to, when we get into more active collections, we might end up having to garnish someone's wages. Or again, when we're in active filing season, we can offset refunds to any taxes that are owed. Those kinds of activities help us to decrease the accounts receivable. Additionally, we work with private collection firms, and we do send debt out to them as well. So we do ask for their assistance when we are, again, working on our AR. Other things that decrease the AR is credits. Again, when we get withholding payments that are remitted from employers on the behalf of the taxpayer, that helps us to take care of any debts that may be out there. Again, penalty waivers, and then if somebody's in court and maybe they have something changed on the adjustment we made, so we decrease the billing, that would reduce the AR as well as cancellations and write-offs that we do in our collection action.
And Chair Manning, if I may, just to your question mm-hmm. a moment ago, on this slide, it's a snapshot of time. And what you'll hear about when we come back in phase two about accounts receivable is it's just a snapshot in time of what's going on. From period to period, there is a lot of activity that's going on. And so there will be a lot of increases to that account, but we're also doing a lot of activity to reduce that and collecting tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars over whatever the period of time is. And so it's just a snapshot in time, and we'll have more detail. In fact, there's more on this next slide, too.
Exactly. Thank you, Eric, for catching that. As this slide is showing, again, I'm just trying to give you a little bit of an idea of what the composition of the AR is, and by looking at it in a little bit different format. When you look at the blue pie chart that I have up there, that is just showing you how it breaks out between personal income tax, withholding, and corporation taxes. And as you can see, about 63% of the AR, or that's around right now, this snapshot in time, around $718 million in taxes owed is what is the personal income tax portion of that. And again, that's just giving you an idea of how it breaks out. The middle pie chart is, again, showing you the type of notices that we have out and how the accounts receivable comes to be. As I was saying, about 50% is from failure to file notices, or those estimated tax assessments that we put out there. The other category, which is kind of that golden color, that is where our assessments and self-assessed, that'd be the self-assessed returns that people file with partial or no payment. And then the 14% is what we generate through audit activities when we inspect returns or through processing adjustments. And finally, the chart on the far right, is the green chart, is just showing you, again, what breaks out between tax penalty and interest, again, to just give you an idea of what kind of makes up the accounts receivable.
Chair Manning, Representative Gomberg, the question you had about percent of that middle graph probably gives a fairly good representation of that.
Thank you, Eric. Yeah. And the last slide I'm showing you here on the collection process, again, is just to help you to understand when we actually get into collections what happens once an account is set up. The column on the far left-hand side is showing you in the first 3 months. So once an account is established, there is an appeal period that, like if I did an audit billing, that somebody does have a right to appeal and to challenge. So we have an appeal period, and we like to wait until all of that is taken care of before we start any active collections. So somewhere between a bill being established either by us or the taxpayer, notices and things start going out. When we get into the third to the 12 months, that's when we really start active collections. And during that stage, we are looking for assets that a person might have that, again, may be wages we might be able to garnish. We'll be looking for any assets that they might own, as far as can we put a lien on a home, or is there something that, again, that we can use to help pay off any tax debt. But again, we're also sending letters out. We're trying to contact people. And our first level of collections is truly to try to get a hold of the person to encourage them to help satisfy the debt by working with us on that. And then once we get past the 12 months, if we haven't collected any dollars, as the last column is showing, then we will send the debt out to private collections. But I want to make sure, too, that we understand that it's all a continuum, and it isn't that everything fits really nice into a column and we don't move into the next stage until X, Y, or Z happens. Especially around private collection firms, we do utilize the firms with out-of-state debt because that's a little bit easier for us to have them collect that for us. And that debt would go out when it's first established. We wouldn't wait for 12 months to send it out. We also send small balance accounts out early, and also if an account is already out at a small collection, or excuse me, at a private collection firm, we will send a new debt out to them, so we're not having the department and a private collection firm both trying to collect from the same taxpayer. But we definitely try to deploy a number of different tools and activities in our collection process to get the dollars collected.
With regard to enforcement activities in the business division, I'll speak about the withholding program for a moment. We have a little bit different compliance challenge in the business community because we have a much smaller population. As I said in an earlier slide, we have 130,000 plus businesses we're monitoring. They need to file quarterly. Some of them need to make payments more often than that. And so we can monitor pretty quickly if there's somebody who was filing and has stopped filing, or if we have information from, say, another agency like employment that they should be filing and they aren't filing. We also investigate for cash under the table businesses, and the work that we do is to try and to get businesses back into compliance. We have do about 3,500 field investigations a year with our team that goes out in the field. And we also participate with an interagency compliance network, which is a partnership with us, employment department, and several other agencies. The goal of that is to identify misclassified employees, as well as to help people understand their obligations for tax and other employment-type taxes. We partnership together and share information. Probably the best thing we do is share information that helps us understand the activity that's going on in the state so that we can make sure that the compliance is taking place at the level it should. We do audits on behalf of each other. The Employment Department and the Department of Revenue each have a person who can conduct a full audit. So if I'm a revenue employee and I go into business, I can conduct an audit not only for the revenue issues, but for the Department of Employment issues as well. And employment has an auditor who can do that as well. And then the last thing I'd probably want to just touch on with regard to enforcement efforts in the withholding section, Joanne has talked about some of the new tools we've had. The withholding program came into our new system just recently, just in rollout 3, which is in November of 2016. We're also able to do a lot more automation and send bills out than we used to do. To give you an example, in the third quarter of 2015, when we were in our legacy system, we had identified over 14,000 businesses that had failed to file a return, and we sent them failure to file notices, but we were only manually able to send out about 3,500 returns or returns that we had filed on their behalf. With our new system, for the third quarter of 2016, we had identified about 10,800 entities that had failed to file, and we were able to send out estimated returns for each one of those. So that is a significant increase in our ability to assess for those who haven't filed and paid. The challenge is that creates a lot more work on the back end that we didn't used to have. People who are calling in and saying, I've closed my business or I no longer have employees. And so we're working through with this new power, if you will, that we have in terms of the throughput to touch more businesses. How do we handle the volume of the workload that's coming through? And we can do that. And we're trying to figure out how to balance that as we learn as we go. On the corporate side, as I mentioned just a moment ago, over 80% of the revenues are paid by 3% of the returns, and that presents an even different compliance challenge. As you can imagine, we want to make sure that we're constantly looking at those entities that are contributing the greatest to our corporate tax revenues. We do cycle audits, so every few years we'll do audits on those businesses. And one of the reasons we need to do that is we find that even when we go in and audit and correct behavior, we find that that behavior isn't corrected necessarily. And so one of the things that we also do is try to look for third-party information that would help us to be able to identify compliance issues for corporations in Oregon. Other states that have a sales tax have a much better advantage than we do in Oregon. If you have a sales tax in your state and a business is reporting the amount of sales that they have had and paying sales tax on that, you can kind of compare that with what they're reporting for an income for their income tax. We don't have that in Oregon, and so it's a little bit more challenging to look for third data sources. We have some, but it's not as easy in Oregon as it is with states that have a sales tax. And I guess the last thing I'd say is the types of issues that we face in the corporate tax program can be litigated, and they can be very complex, and that can take sometimes years to resolve, and that takes some time as a part of our enforcement efforts as well. And that concludes our section on enforcement. Again, we'll be back to talk about some of these other topics that we had touched on today at a later time. And now I'd like to move into our last three.
Question of Representative Humbers.
Yes.
Thank you. And I understand we're going to be going into more detail here, but as I'm looking over your numbers, one of the things that jumped out at me was a category called adjustments. And you haven't touched on adjustments, but I noticed adjustments for this last year of about $150 million. So how do I get my taxes adjusted?
Let me get back to where we were.
Chair Manning, Representative Gomberg, are you looking at the LFO report, or are you looking at our slide?
I was looking at the LFO report on delinquent debt, and it provides some details for the Department of Revenue, what your beginning balance was, what your collections were, your write-offs, your adjustments, and your reversals. And the adjustment line indicates $150 million. So if you need to check on that and get back to me, that would be fine. But I'd like to know a little bit more about how we take the amount of debt we've got and adjust it down $150 million.
Chair Manning, Representative Gomberg, we'll get back to you on that. I think there's a few pieces to that, and we're happy to get you that information.
Thank you very much. Yeah,
I think we'd like to share that with the full committee.
Yes, sir.
We'll do that.
So the third outcome area that I'd like to touch on briefly is employee engagement, and that's something that we take very seriously at the department. Our human resources department and the director's office has been leading this effort over the last several years, and we're learning how to find ways to make sure that our workforce is engaged. And one of the things that we do is take the temperature of that by conducting an employee engagement survey every spring. The survey gives us an idea from year to year. An independent third party conducts the survey. It's the same questions each year, so we can compare year over year. And it gives us an idea of how employees are feeling about their work, how connected they are to our mission, our vision, and we get a lot of good information from that. Over the last year, we noticed, and we've had increases in our employee engagement, and then this last year we saw a slight decrease, and it was not unexpected. Our employees have been through a lot. We have, the last 3.5 years, been working very hard to keep the lights on and do the things we need to do while completely re-engineering our business processes, which means there's been a lot of extra work for testing the new system, a lot of extra time and training to learn how the new system. And then it can be a little bit scary when you have a system that goes live on a day and you're on the phone with customers navigating in a new system for the first time, as well trained as we tried to make them and whatnot. And so we appreciate the hard work that our staff has done. They've done a great job. They're doing well. The programs that have been in our system since rollout one, and now those that are in rollout two, they're getting used to the system, they're using it well, they're appreciating it. But that's one of the things that we've noticed by our survey, is that our employees, they definitely were impacted by this core systems replacement project and how challenging it has been for them. One of the things we do is look for key themes. The employees are they provide comments to us, and so we look for key themes based on their comments and then look to see if there are things we can do to address some of the things that they raise in the survey. And then the change leadership, the second slide there, is a practice of understanding what people are struggling with in a changing environment. We invested heavily in that during our project, and one of the outcomes of that investment is we had people that we had contracted with who are skilled at this help coach our managers in how to lead employees through change. And so the skills that our managers have learned about how to coach employees are skills that they're going to continue to be able to use as we go forward and lead the organization. And then the final thought I would just have on this slide is one of the things we've come to understand is that employees that you invest in to train are often more engaged. And so we take training very seriously as well, whether it's soft skills training for communications or customer service skills or technical training. Obviously, we had a lot of training for our new system. But that's one thing that we try also to take very seriously, is to provide the appropriate training for our staff.
Right, and I'm going to switch us back to another topic, which is around customer experience or customer service. I've mentioned along the way, as Eric has, that our new system does provide a lot of new services and features for folks to use online, and I won't necessarily go back and restate all those. But I also want to mention and just own that we do have a key performance measure, key performance 4, that is a customer experience or customer service measure, and we know that that reflects a very, what appears to be poor performance on our part when it comes to providing service. One of the things that we have been looking into is how we collect the data on that particular topic. We thought we had a good process where we had a phone survey that folks could use, and we were finding that we were not getting a lot of participation. In addition, I think we also had a lot of folks that were just frustrated with us, and they would say, yeah, let me take that survey. So we've been we've been looking at those numbers going down, and I do want to assure you, I hear a lot of really good conversations. I sit right off the collectors, and I hear a lot of people doing really good work. But at the same time, our data is saying something else about our business, and we do take this key performance very, very, very seriously. Some of the things that we've done in order to start, you know, figuring out what's going on and where do we really need to work in improving ourselves is how we collect the data. We also recognized maybe we weren't as expert about how to collect customer service information. So one of the things that we did in 2015 and we repeated in 2016 was to ask Oregon State University to assist us with a survey. So they did a paper survey. In both years, they surveyed about 7,000 taxpayers who, if we're willing, would send their paper survey and provide us information and comments and different things on that level. During that time frame, we also recognized we wanted to receive some more expertise help, so we went out to look for a consultant, and we were able to find somebody, but we were not able to get them on board with us until about July of 2016. One of the tasks that we're asking of our consultant is, one, to help us to identify a tool where we can better collect information, and two, that we have analytics to go with it, and number three, then that we also have a team trained at Revenue so we can look at that information and then make decisions on what we need to do. We were able to find a tool working with our contractor Propeller, and we launched that tool in December of 2016. And unfortunately, we don't have enough information and data collected today for me to give you any kind of a reliable statistic, but I can tell you the good thing that we're seeing is that we are getting a broader spectrum of programs information collected as well as participation. One of the things that we're doing to collect information is, one, we ask staff to please inform people when they're working with them that they can take a survey, and we also add a link to any correspondence or an email where people can go online and take the survey as well. In our field offices, we've installed a survey tool, an iPad, where a customer then can step over and take a survey as well, so we're beginning to gather information from that. But in addition to just learning about collecting data and trying to find out more about ourselves, we've also invested in training for our staff as well. So over the last year and a half, we've provided communication training, telephone skills training for those that works in our call centers, and that would be in our general tech services call center or in our collection areas, as well as we also did in my division a training around emotional intelligence, which it was to help the employees understand better about relating with the taxpayers and understanding maybe the direction where the taxpayer is coming from in order to enhance how we work with taxpayers. We have a variety of options that people can write to us through email boxes also to get a hold of us. That also is a way that we get a lot of comments about, again, service. I think that's what I kind of wanted to cover on that. And the biggest piece that I just wanted to make sure that I stress again today is that we definitely understand that we have areas that we can improve on this particular area, and we're definitely working toward that for the department.
And our final outcome area, as we get close to wrapping up our presentation, that I want to share with today is called equity and uniformity. This is an area that is important to all of us in our programs, even though it has a significant meaning for the property tax program, which you'll hear of tomorrow. But for us in our income tax programs, we want to be as consistent as we possibly can be in how we treat all taxpayers. One of the things that's helped us to do that has been integrating into one system. We were in multiple systems. We were kind of siloed in our legacy environment. And the way that certain things were done in our organization could have been inconsistent because they weren't in one system. And so one of the opportunities we've had the last few years is we've used one integrated system and modernized our business processes is to look at how we can make sure we standardize a lot of those processes across the organization. And here's just an example of three of them: audit management review, refund review, and penalty waivers. But though we have those tools, people are the people who are actually making the decisions. The tools just help us have better information to make the decisions, and so also making sure that we're working with our staff to make sure that we're consistent in our behavior as well. And training is also a big part of that. The other thing I'd bring to your attention is we look outside of ourselves to make sure that the way we're behaving here in Oregon is appropriate for what we're doing by partnering with other people across the country. And two key relationships we have are with the Multi-State Tax Commission and the Federation of Tax Administrators. The Multi-State Tax Commission convenes roughly 30 states who work on primarily on corporate tax law, and we have model statutes and model rules that we can adopt from the work that we're doing with other states. And the goal there is that if you have a business that's doing business in multiple states, the states are trying to make it as easy as possible for them to comply by being as uniform as possible across all the states. One of the other things that we do by working with the Federation of Tax Administrators is they provide great forums for information sharing. We just had a compliance forum here in February where we learned from them about fraud detection. We learned from each other about different compliance strategies. And the information that we share with each other, we can take back to our home states and try and keep those best practices growing here in Oregon as well. So that's just a little bit about equity and uniformity, which is the final outcome area we have. A couple more slides, and then we'll be through.
And I'm just going to touch base, again, just some of the challenges that we have. As Eric and I have been saying, we have this nice new system, and we're learning how to use it. It provides a lot of opportunity for long-term efficiency gains, but that's one of the things that we also have discovered is that we have a lot of learning to do and how to best utilize this tool. So we'll be doing that, I'm sure, for the next several years to come, especially as more programs have more time in the system. But all areas at the agency have been impacted, from collections to account management to enforcement and how we analyze data. It's going to take us time to fully acclimate to use this new system, but we've also discovered, too, that we've also had opportunities to change some of our business practices already. In particular, in my area, I have realigned some workflows. I mentioned about filing enforcement and how we could automate some of our work up front. We've been able to take that staff and redeploy them to other work within the agency. But we also, as Eric was saying too, we have, as we've been leading people through change, we've also have challenges with getting our staff used to new systems and processes that they may have been very comfortable with old systems and old processes, and how do you do things under the new system? And that creates some challenges for us as well. We know that changes aren't finalized, but we also know that we have the ability to make a lot of improvements in our business activities. And we're definitely committed to doing things as effective and efficiently as we can.
And our final slide, for those of you who are newer to the committee, you probably, why are they talking so much about this system? Well, for some of us, we've been before this committee for many years, first to ask for permission to do the project and the funding to do it. And for me, who's been along the journey along the way, it's exciting to be on this side of it, where now we're realizing some of the benefits and starting to look forward. We're able to be in a position now where we have a technology environment where we can go forward for years to come that we think is going to be sound. Many other states use this system, and so I just want to say thank you for the support that we've had over the years to be able to put us in position. The revenues that we take pride in administering on behalf of the legislature and the state so that we can provide the services that we provide, I feel very confident that we'll be able to do that well into the future now with the investment you've made. So thank you for that. I hope you heard that we're learning, but we're also driving to be as effective as we can be. We're looking outside of ourselves to figure out how we can continuously improve to do our work as well as we can. And as Joanne just said, though we're still in a learning mode and shaking things down, we're still keeping the lights on, and we're able to do the business day to day that we need to do. The automation opportunities are very nice, but that's a powerful tool in terms of our ability to send a lot of notices out, and we're being attentive to how much work that creates in other areas of our organization and making sure that we're balanced. And so in closing, I would just say thank you. We'll be in good shape for years to come. It's our hope you'll continue to invest in us and give us the support that it'll take to fund that system into the future, too, as we continue to maintain that for years to come. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Let's open it up to questions. Representative Marsh?
I think this is probably not a question for you, but maybe we can take a note for sometime later in the week. I'd be interested to know if you know what percentage of employees in the Department of Revenue are retirement eligible.
Mr. Chair, Representative Marsh, we'll look for that information for you and for the committee.
Thank you.
Other question, Representative?
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Manning. So you're pretty much done implementing your software core systems upgrade then. And then you talked about that you have some customer service issues, or even say, possible customer service issues? Because you brought up that it might be the way that you're collecting the data, and I get that. Mm-hmm. That the minute you give me bad news and then tell me, hey, do you want to be in our survey? I say, oh, yeah, I'll give it to you guys, whatever. So I get it that that maybe goes on. But can you talk about the relationship between that software and your ability to deliver customer service? Does that software help you, or does it hurt you? Or just talk a little bit about that.
Well, Chair Manning and Representative Nierman, I'll begin with an answer, and Eric and I may have to blend it together. From my standpoint, I think the answer is kind of yes and yes and maybe. And what I mean by that is the system gives us a lot of opportunity. Like I described, we have our revenue online. It gives us tools for taxpayers to interact with us better. It may give them, you know, opportunities to have more control over their accounts in the future, to interact with us through that tool. At the same time, our system also allows us to do maybe more actions. As Eric was saying, we can automate things. And one of the pieces that he talked about, there's that balance of we can spit out a lot of things, but we also have to think about the impact that it does have on taxpayers or business community, and is that the direction we want to go? So I hope I'm answering your question by saying, yeah, it does provide us both, but we're trying to have a balanced approach so it isn't just, you know, we could hammer a lot of things out, but we're not sure that that's always the best in tax administration, just to bill a bunch of people just because we can, without maybe trying to work with them in a different way first. So I hope, Eric, if that's anything that you would add to that.
Oh, Chair Barnhart, Representative Nierman, I think the biggest thing, as Joanne said, in terms of helping with customer service, is there's a lot of different types of programs that we administer and a lot of things that people can get online now that they used to have to call or write us for. And so there's just a much more information that's accessible now for people that want to do that. And so that's probably the biggest leap that the new system made, as Joanne said. And that's the connection I would make to your question.
Thank you. Can I follow?
Follow up.
So just real quickly, how are your employees digesting the new software system? Do they like it, or is there a rebellion going on? Or
Chair Manning, Representative Nierman, I think it depends on where they are and which rollout. If you talk to the people who are in, the people who just came out of rollout 3, they're still working through it. And but if you talk to the people who are in rollout 1 in the corporate program, they're used to it, they're accustomed to it, and there are a lot of benefits to it that they see that they didn't have before in terms of how they can. We don't have to wait for overnight batch processing for a lot of transactions. If someone makes a payment, it shows up there. We can give an account balance right there. And so there are a lot of things that they're accustomed to. So I think it just depends on where you are in that continuum and that change curve as you go through that change.
Right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. During our roadshow for Ways and Means, numerous people keep testifying that we're the lowest corporate tax rate in the United States. Other things I show us about in the middle. Do you have any comment? Or
Chair Manning, Senator DeBoer, those are good questions for your legislative revenue staff. I see, depending on how you can stack the information, how it might show up. I can tell you what our rates are. If you have less than $1 million in Oregon sales, you're at a 6.6 tax rate. If you're over $1 million in Oregon sales, you're at 7.6%. How that stacks up against the other corporate tax rates around the country, I think your legislative revenue staff can help you with that, if that's all right, if I may.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I guess we'll be waiting for them to come up next time. All right, they've been there. I haven't seen them yet. Great. So if there is any other questions from the committee, just wondering, since we got a little extra time, I don't know the committee's pleasure. Well, we can wrap this up for the day. If you have other things you got to do, I got hit, not saying wrap it up for the day. So, okay. Is there anything else regarding this hearing? Okay, if there's no further questions, we're going to close the public hearing on SB 5535, Department of Revenue.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so before we
the next meeting, off to the Property Tax Division and their special programs.
So. Okay. Well, if everybody is at ease, then we're going to end this session for the day, and we're going to reconvene tomorrow, March 14th at 1500. That's 3 o'clock for civilians. We are adjourned. for civilians.